Hi, folks. Be sure to visit my website at dr-history.com for a short personal video message, to listen to the latest stories, and to leave a comment.
Well, it's that time on Tuesdays for this man to walk in wearing his buckskins, carrying a flintlock rifle and a coonskin cap, and that cap stinks. Good morning, Dr. History.
I'm going to leave the hat out in the pickup.
Please, the flies,
yeah,
the flies.
Yeah. Good morning, Zeb. I want to apologize for last week. We had a real difficult time for the local listeners. And so, folks, if you missed last week, you can go to my webpage, dr-history.com, or just Google Dr. History, and you'll be able to listen to last week's show. I apologize. I re-recorded it, and you should be able to hear it okay.
Okay. Yeah, we had some technical difficulties.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Cell phones should all be laying in the bottom of the Snake River.
Well, I couldn't have reached it from my house, but could have got it halfway there.
What are we going to do?
Yeah, so this is the last Tuesday of the month of March, which we've been honoring women of the Old West.
Yes.
and people that I think have not been heard of much. So today, we're going to talk about frontier teachers.
Wow, that's a good subject. Those people really, they had to be tough.
They did, and you'll know as I go along here. So there's a quote here by Emmeline Wells. She says, "In their way, pioneer women were the molders and shapers of Western society, mothers, wives, business owners, school moms, slowly but surely exerting their influence on the cities, towns, and communities in which they lived." Now, I come from a line of school teachers, Zeb. My dad started teaching south of Filer in a one-room schoolhouse that where they lived in it, and he taught grades 1 through, I think, 5 or 6.
I went to a country school.
Yeah.
And 1 through 8.
And in some ways, that was a good thing.
I think my education was as good as anything.
Yeah. So, picture this. Okay, it's a warm noonday sun. It was shining down on this small little log schoolhouse near the base of a mountain overlooking the Missoula Valley in Montana.
Mm-hmm.
The year is 1878. The windows of the building were open, and there was a nice breeze kind of filtering through into the single room that had 11 students. Olive Pickering was a young teacher from New Hampshire. She sat behind her desk reading aloud to her class. Her students were just enthralled with the story. They were hanging on every word. Now, picture this. Outside, there are several Native American from the Salish tribe, and they were perched on a post just listening to the lesson.
So the Indians were outside.
Outside, right.
Why? They weren't invited inside?
Well, or wouldn't come.
I see.
But they were outside. So the story fascinated both the pupils and the Indians that were outside. Now, when she got through with the lesson and dismissed the class, she watched the Indians. They kind of hung around for a little bit. Then they headed off to their homes.
Did they understand English?
They must have been able to at this point. Because that was 1897, somewhere in there. So, or 1878. So probably they did. But beginning in 1846, there were hordes of settlers and their families traveled by land and water, converged on the west from all parts of the country. And a lot of them were hunting for gold or to mine or good farmland or a good place to ranch. They explored or settled every part of the region from Nome, Alaska to Santa Fe, New Mexico. And towns sprang into existence. And with this influx of people, of course, they always formed a church. They made laws. Schools were established. And concerned parents realized they needed to establish a formal education system. So schools are necessary and good teachers along with them. And without them, their children would become what they called orphans of progress. So they saw the need and the importance.
That's what I was going to ask you.
Education.
Did the families that lived on the frontier at that time, did they respect education enough to really want their kids to go?
I think it depended on the parents' attitude. You know, I think some parents may have thought, nah, you don't need that. You just need to know how to work.
I see.
And others, I think, thought, yeah, you need to learn how to read and write and do math, things like that. But the pioneers who felt the same had the foresight to set aside land where schools could be built. And later they sought contributions from the residents for the upkeep of the schoolhouse and supplies for the pupils. So the local people had to support the school. It was not done by a county or a state or anything like that at that point.
At that point, it wasn't taxation. It was just donation?
Right, exactly.
I see.
Now, among the population pushing the boundaries of the Mississippi River were daring female educators who hoped to find work teaching frontier boys and girls how to read and write. And all that was initially required of teachers was that they be able to count, read and write, and mend a pen. A quill pen. That was it. So there was no requirements as far as college or anything. But these new school marms were energetic, and they arrived. They were able to just do a lot of things other than teach the basics. So now some immigrants felt it was only proper that a schoolmaster teach their children, a man, how to read and write, and the scarcity of professionals of either gender on the frontier made it impractical to turn away women who offered this service. So according to an 1890 census, 11% of the country's female teachers lived in the West. Now, although studies in the 1870s showed that pupils under women teachers had actually improved more than those taught by men.
Really?
School marms were still paid less. Women educators were paid $54.50 a year.
How much?
$54.50 a year.
Oh, my.
A man, a schoolmaster, was paid $71.40.
Holy cow.
Even though they were the better teachers, the female.
A year.
Yeah.
Now, did they supply, they being the community, the living quarters and everything?
I think it would depend on the community.
I see.
In some cases, they would take turns living with families.
Oh.
For, say, a month at a time or a few weeks at a time. But educational pioneers encouraged ladies to enter the field and take their talent into this wild and uncharted territory. And it was against the popular notion that men made better teachers because they were more firm with the students. But I guarantee you there were some
female... They didn't know my grade school teacher.
Hey, I lived in fear for a few of mine. I didn't dare cross.
Mrs. Kiltz, God bless you in heaven.
Yeah. So between 1847 and 58, more than 600 female teachers traveled across the frontier to provide youngsters with an education. There were few opportunities for respectable work for women in the early 1800s. So teaching was the most popular profession for women in the 1840s.
How did they make it on like $50 a year?
Well, I'm going to bet that most of them did something else, too. You know, sewing or whatever. But there was a gal by the name of Luella Fergus. She was a 14-year-old girl living in Illinois. It was the only thing she wanted to do. And she had a father living in Montana Territory in 1862. And she wrote him a letter and asking about the requirements that she needed to enter the field of teaching. And so what he said is, if you can do sums and fractions, you can teach. So basically, if you knew how to do a little bit of math, you could be a teacher.
You were in.
Yeah. Now, there's a lady that I talked about a year or two back. Her name was Sister Blandini.
I remember that.
And she was the one, if you go back and listen to that, she was one of the ones that nursed one of Billy the Kid's partners back to health.
Yeah.
Anyway, she taught in the New Mexico Territory in the 1880s for virtually no pay. Any funds that were donated to her for her work, she turned back into the school to be used to purchase writing utensils, books, upgrades to the schoolhouse. There was another lady, Sarah Royce, initially agreed to teach the children the three R's in her home in Grass Valley, California, in 1857, in exchange for homemade preserves and eggs. So no money exchanged hands.
Hmm.
So the motivation was just to improve the minds of boys and girls in the land. So you had to have a real passion, I guess, or dedication to wanting to teach.
I was going to say, I mean, a lot of movies, Western movies, portrayed the early school marms, if you will. One in particular that I know you've seen, and it's been done three or four different times. My favorite was with Joel McRae, the Virginian.
Oh, okay.
And see, his girlfriend was a teacher from back east that came out to the Wild West in Wyoming.
And I'm going to talk a little bit about something related to that.
Oh.
So, but the teachers who did receive a regular salary felt that educating the youngsters was necessary for the betterment of mankind. And some actually believed that it was a divine duty.
Really?
It was kind of like a call from God to teach, okay?
Yeah.
Flora Davis Winslow in 1875, in her journal, she said, quote, "I teach school because I wish to be independent and not beholden to my friends for a livelihood. I go west to do the will of my Father in heaven."
Wow.
Pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Now, for many students, their teachers were heroic figures who introduced them to a whole world of possibilities. The educators were resourceful. They were tenacious. They were fearless. Olive Mann Isbell and Hannah Clapp came to class armed with guns in order to keep their students safe from hostile Indians who threatened them.
Are you kidding?
No. Now, I'll tell you another story.
Ooh.
There was a school out here that the boys kept running off the teachers.
Uh-huh.
The next teacher that came in happened to be a man. He walked up to the front of the class, pulled out a six-shooter, and laid it on the table, on the desk. He didn't have any trouble with the boys after
Imagine
that.
Imagine that.
Yeah, pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So Mary McClench Gray and Lucia Darling trekked hundreds of miles over treacherous country to bring their gift of teaching to boys and girls in the most remote areas of the Western region. Limited school books and supplies did not stop teachers like Eliza Mott from helping children to learn how to read.
Now, why have I heard that name before? Did you do a story on her?
I might have a long time ago, but get this, Eb. She taught the alphabet to her students using the inscriptions on tombstones at a nearby cemetery. That's how she taught them how to read.
What a quaint little classroom.
Yes. Come on, folks. We're going to go to the cemetery.
Oh, I can't hardly wait.
We're going to learn your ABCs, you know. But pioneer communities grew in prosperity and stability as a result of the work of these early teachers. Now, a lot of these educators displayed courage in other ways. In addition to her talent for teaching, Elizabeth Scott possessed a daring drive to see to it that neglected children in black communities had an opportunity to learn as well as the children of white settlers. In 1854, she opened the first African-American school in Sacramento. Now, Elizabeth, a widow with three children who had moved to California from New Bedford, Massachusetts, taught 14 pupils in a small classroom in the basement of her home. And just in a few years, 5 years, by 1859, the number of pupils enrolled at the school were more than 200.
I need you to move that mic.
How's that?
That's good right there.
So she was a pioneer in starting teaching for African American.
They really
kids.
Were dedicated.
They were. They were. It's amazing. Now, Swedish-born teacher Elise Amelie immigrated to the Texas Panhandle in 1847. She did not have a teaching position, but she helped raise money to build the first school in the small town of Hamilton. Elizabeth Miller Wilson traveled to the Oregon Territory in 1851 in hopes of educating the native Chinook people, and she actually learned to speak the language. She took a teaching position at the reservation, and you know, just an amazing, again, dedication to learn a language you had no idea what it was. But without the school marms who came over the plains to be instruments of good, westward advancement, it would have stagnated. I mean, education was absolutely critical.
Hmm.
Now, one of the first and only textbooks children used in classrooms across the frontier was the... Zeb?
The Bible.
No.
I don't know.
McGruffy Reader.
Oh, the McGruffy Reader.
I know you've heard of that.
Yep.
And
yep.
It was written by Reverend Dr. William Holmes McGuffey.
But going back to my answer, the Bible was used
a lot. Oh, yes. Yeah, I'm sure it had to be. Well, in the homes, no doubt. Yeah. But he was a Pennsylvania-born educator and president of Ohio University, and the material introduced children to a series of characters that were honest, truthful, and kind. The easy-to-follow, predominantly one-syllable word fables of people of every age and from every walk of life. And the book contained a total of 55 stories.
Wow.
And that was used, you know, who knows how many
thousands. Do you have
a
copy of that?
I do not. I think it would be fun to have that.
I was just going to say, and I'm not trying to be funny, I mean, that would be really a keepsake on a bookshelf.
You know, it really would. So I'm going to tell you about some rules for teachers.
Okay.
In 1872. Number one, teachers each day will fill lamps and clean chimneys.
Clean the chimney?
Well, now, I think that may be the chimney on the lamp, wouldn't you think?
I don't know.
I mean, well, it can't be the fireplace chimney.
I wouldn't think it would be.
To do that every day?
Yeah.
I think, didn't they refer to the glass on a lamp as the chimney?
Yeah.
Because they would get kind of smoky.
Yeah.
Okay, so number two. Each teacher will bring a bucket of water and a scuttle of coal for the day's session.
What's a scuttle?
That's like a bucket. It's a bucket with a kind of a lip around it.
Okay, but why did they have to bring in the coal?
Because I suppose that's the only thing they had to heat their Franklin stove with.
Okay, all right.
So they probably didn't have an actual fireplace.
I see.
Just one of those metal stoves.
I see.
So, number three, make your pens carefully. You may whittle nibs to the individual taste of the pupils.
Huh.
So,
okay, I'm assuming
the feather pens.
The quill, and then whittle it down so it fits their fingers or whatever?
I guess, yeah.
Okay.
So, men teachers may take one evening each week for courting purposes, or two evenings a week if they go to church regularly.
Ah, you got it. Yes, sir.
In other words, if you're going to date, you better go to church.
There you go.
Now, number five, after 10 hours in school, the teachers may spend the remaining time reading the Bible or other good books.
10 hours a day?
10 hours a day.
Wow.
Now, I can't imagine the students being there for 10 hours.
I can't either.
And maybe it was just they had to be in the school. I don't know. So number six, women teachers who marry or engage in unseemly conduct will be dismissed. So they couldn't marry.
They're gone.
Yeah. Number seven, every teacher should lay aside from each day a goodly sum of his earnings for his benefit during his declining years so that he will not become a burden on society.
Pretty hard to do that on 50 bucks a year.
$54. Well, and if you're only getting eggs and,
holy
you know, what do you put away?
They're not going to keep forever.
Yeah, yeah. Number eight, any teacher who smokes, uses liquor in any form, frequents pool or public halls, wait for this one, Zeb, or gets shaved in a barber shop, will give good reason to suspect his worth, intentions, integrity, and honesty.
You're kidding.
So evidently, the barber shops were not a place that you should frequent.
I see.
For whatever reason.
Oh, my goodness.
Number nine. The teacher who performs his labor faithfully and without fault for 5 years will be given an increase of 25 cents per week in his pay.
Why?
Providing, Zeb, the Board of Education approves.
Why? Don't go spend that foolishly.
That's a whole dollar a month more, Zeb.
Holy cow.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just... you know, like I say, I've got, my dad was a school teacher. I had two uncles that were school teachers. I had a daughter that taught for a while.
I got to ask you, when did they start a certification process?
I don't know when that actually started. I know my father and a lot of the teachers in this area went up to Albion. It was called the Southern Idaho College of Education and also called the Albion Normal School. And, at one time, it was considered to be going to be the county seat of Cajun County, but then the government closed the college, and of course, then it ended up down in Burley. But I appreciate some of my teachers. I really have to say that I had some teachers that had a huge influence on me, and when I got to college, I had a professor that really, really influenced me to the fact that I came to the realization that I could do better in college. I just had to work harder.
Yeah.
And I appreciate forever his attitude towards, you know, you better get to work or you're not going to be in my class kind of thing.
I had teachers like that, and I go back to my grade school teacher, Mrs. Kiltz, and believe me, that lady had the biggest influence on my life. And I had an occasion when she was 97 years old. I flew home to see my family one time, and she was in a retirement home, a rest home, and I made it a point to go see her. And that was the greatest treat that I ever had in my life.
Yeah. Well, like I say, to me, there's several professions that are underpaid: school teachers, firemen, and policemen.
Oh, absolutely.
In fact,
absolutely.
Around here, a lot of the school teachers, I'm going to say most of them, had other things. Like, we had a farm.
Yeah.
So in the spring and the fall, we spent a lot of late nights getting crops in, and in the fall, getting a lot of crops, you know, hay and stuff. So
I enjoyed that. We have never, in my opinion, really gone in depth into the teachers in the Old West.
Right. And I actually have given two or three stories in here about some of the teachers.
Wow.
But one of them was a lady that was in the Donner Party.
Really?
Yeah, Martha Graves, I believe. She was in the Donner Party, and she was in the rescue party that left and headed over to get rescued.
Wow.
She survived and became a school teacher over there.
Oh, my. Now, that's a story I want to hear.
Yeah, and I have done that. It was quite a while ago,
okay.
This Martha Graves.
Dr. History, you hit it out of the park. That was interesting.
Well, it's a profession that's near to my heart.
Yeah, I can see that.
My father taught me 7th grade PE, 8th grade math, 9th grade driver's ed, and 9th grade basketball coach.
As far as the driver's ed is concerned, your dad let you slip a little bit on certain things.
Well,
you still ran over my water deals in the lawn.
Okay, the funny thing is, he didn't do that with my next three brothers. I guess he figured he ruined me and didn't want to take a chance with my brothers.
Oh, I love this program. Some of your stories are absolutely excellent. Thank you very much. Dr. History right here on Zeb at the Ranch. Next week, you've got the material all set up.
Oh, absolutely. You know how I am.
Oh, I do. That's what scares me.